This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Sea level rise is baked into the cake now. Greenland and Antarctica are melting, as are all other land glaciers. We are committed to a world where ports and port cities become swamped, delta farmlands become invaded by salty water, and maps of the coastlines have to be updated every 10 years or less. Will we wait until the next storm surge wipes out homes and infrastructure? Will we dumbly try to rebuild everything while pretending sea level rise is not real? Will we wait to panic or plan a retreat that makes sense? Coming up, the first in a two-part series called Retreat from the Sea. From Staten Island to Papua New Guinea and now in the Bahamas, climate change forces people to retreat from the storm-tossed rising sea. Retreat means defeat. Or does it? It turns out planned retreat is an emerging field of study, policy, and current events. We are joined by a known expert in the field, Dr. A.R. Siders. She has a law degree from Harvard University and a doctorate from Stanford. Ann Siders worked on recovery in New York and New Jersey after Hurricane Sandy in 2012. She just joined the faculty at the University of Delaware working with the Disaster Research Center. Her latest paper, published in the journal Science, is The Case for Strategic and Managed Climate Retreat: Why, Where, When, and How Should Communities Relocate? Dr. Siders, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
When Hurricane Sandy wiped out communities in Staten Island, residents organized buyout groups, but politicians from New York, like State Senator Chuck Schumer and then Mayor Michael Bloomberg, were against it. Schumer said the drive to rebuild on those exposed shorelines shows the spirit of New York. What ultimately happened for those Staten Islanders wanting to retreat?
There was initially some resistance to the idea of retreat, especially in a city like New York, where they have a housing crisis, particularly an affordable housing crisis. And the concern was that if you lose hundreds of homes from Staten Island, where else are you going to find hundreds of homes to replace them, especially single-family affordable homes? So initially, there was some resistance against this, but then the community members themselves, especially within Oakwood Beach, learned about the potential to retreat from their neighborhood, and to do this through a federal program from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, through FEMA. So they organized, and they approached the state government and found support from the state government for this program. So then the state and city had a discussion about where and how extensive the retreat effort would be, and eventually ended up relocating several hundred properties on Staten Island and throughout New York City.
Why did people living in Kivalina, Alaska, need to relocate?
Kivalina is a small community on the northern and western coast of Alaska. It's very exposed to sea level rise and also to coastal erosion. It's very windswept. Because there's so much erosion, buildings are becoming unstable, and it can be a very dangerous place to live. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers actually went in and did a study with a number of Alaska Native villages in Alaska, determined that because of permafrost melting, coastal erosion, and other threats, these buildings are no longer safe or stable, and the community is losing so much land that they need to relocate somewhere else in order to be viable in the long term.
So you participated in the case against ExxonMobil launched by the residents of Kivalina. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I was not involved in that case. I know about it from an academic standpoint. The residents of Kivalina were trying to say that oil companies are the people who are putting fossil fuels into the atmosphere. They're the ones who are creating climate change and the greatest harm. So perhaps they should have a liability to pay for the damages that are occurring, such as coastal erosion and sea level rise. The case, however, was dismissed because the court found that you couldn't find a direct connection between an individual company like ExxonMobil doing its job, getting fuel and energy for people doing the things that are perfectly legal in the United States, and a specific outcome such as an individual community experiencing coastal erosion and sea loss. It's one of the big challenges with climate change that everybody's actions are contributing to it, and these companies are contributing significantly, but you can't tie particular business actions to particular outcomes. And so the law has trouble dealing with something on the scale of climate change.
It's my understanding the Ninth Circuit of the U.S. Court of Appeals did not make a ruling about the merits of claiming Big Oil conspired to mislead the public about the dangers of climate change, so I guess that one is still legally out there.
That is my understanding. I have not seen any cases on this, but it's also not an area I have actively researched, so I could be overlooking something. So oftentimes a court can dismiss a case based on the idea of standing, the sort of initial hurdles you have to get through before the court makes a finding. And in this case, they did not reach that finding.
So when it comes to retreat, I also worry there's big opposition coming from billionaire real estate developers and the politicians they support. And then Wall Street and the banks count on that high real estate value, too, as part of their collateral. Do you think there is a conspiracy of silence about the real dangers of coastal development?
I think that the incentives are definitely aligned for people not to want to know about the risk and not to want to admit that their actions in building in risky areas, like on the coast or in the wildlife urban interface, create risk and put people at risk. When developers or real estate agents come in, they earn their money and they're gone again very quickly. It's the people who live there who have to deal with the consequences 20 years down the road.
You know, I worry about Bangladesh. They have the largest single population exposed to massive flooding as the sea levels rise and the storms get bigger. Have you heard about the peninsula principles that came out of Bangladesh on how they're going to handle internal migration?
I have not. What are those?
Okay. Well, I'll send you a link to that because that's some pretty hot stuff. It was developed in 2015, and basically Bangladesh came up with some rules on how they were going to handle people who had to be moved out because they have such low-lying delta areas that the seas are just invading there. So something to look up, and I'm also going to be looking up the case in Panama that I hadn't heard about at all in a place called Guniala, where they also had to withdraw. It's happening all over. Now, you wrote in your new paper in Science, along with your co-authors, of course, quote, even in areas experiencing overall growth, some people are retreating, such as in Manila, Nairobi, and New York City. Do you know what happened with retreat in Manila or Nairobi?
So Dr. Jola Ajibad, I might be mispronouncing her name, has actually just published a paper. She's at Portland State University. She's just published a paper that's come out doing a comparative case on relocation in Nairobi and Manila. And she looks at how communities are being relocated away from at-risk places and how those same cities are also developing new developments and trying to grow economically. So she describes a case in Nairobi of how low-income residents, informal settlements, are being displaced, sometimes forcibly evicted from places where they've been living. And this is seen as a resilience measure because these people need to be made safe by moving them. But then she also describes how the city is investing in major new developments in very similar at-risk places. But because it's for the wealthy, it's seen as economic development and it's somehow not seen as a risk. And so there's this huge inequity in terms of how we treat people differently based purely on their income level.
Let's talk about the negative reaction to the word retreat. How do people react, and can we redefine retreat in a better way?
Retreat can be very difficult. People immediately see it as we're losing that battle. And one of my favorite quotes on this comes from U.S. Marine Corps General Oliver Smith. He gave this phrase, he says, retreat? Hell, we're just advancing in a new direction. And I love this idea because it's very kind of ridiculously oorah Marine Corps, but it's also very insightful that retreat doesn't mean you're losing. Sometimes retreat means you're choosing your battles. You're choosing not to fight here, but to take a step back, take stock, and move forward in a new direction. And that's exactly what we're doing with managed retreat. Sometimes it means we're just picking this battle. Right now, we're fighting all over the world to hold the ocean in place. And that might not be the best battle for us to fight. It might even be ridiculous for us to continue thinking about our relationship with the ocean as a battle and a war. We need to stop seeing it as a fight. In terms of relabeling it, it's kind of a consistent joke within the managed retreat field, but it's also true that there's going to be a great prize for whoever can figure out the right phrasing for a better word. People try all kinds of synonyms. People talk about unbuilding or undevelopment, about relocation, resettlement, renewal, One of my favorites was aggressive resilience for moving people back. The problem is that all of these terms come with their own history. Resettlement in the United States has a particular history, especially if you're talking about Native American tribes. Renewal can talk about, can sound like urban renewal, which also has a history of inequity and social injustice. So finding a word that has some of the same meaning but no negative connotations is incredibly difficult. And believe me, we're all trying to find a better word there.
In a 2016 article in the journal Public Culture, Liz Kozlov adds a broader definition. She writes, quote, "Retreat is distinct from other kinds of climate-related migration in that it entails not just relocating a group of people, but also unbuilding land and returning it to nature in perpetuity," end quote. So there is more to it than just letting the sea take over the ruins.
Yeah, there certainly is. And this is an important distinction, particularly in the United States. So there are multiple federal programs that will come in after a disaster and might offer to buy a homeowner's house if it's been damaged by floods or storms or other hazards. And some of those programs will return the land, will unbuild the building, and they will return the land to natural space and to public space. And some of those programs will turn around and redevelop the land and sell it to another developer and put other people at risk in that same location. So distinguishing between those two programs, both of which are sometimes sold as, you know, you both hear them described as floodplain acquisition or floodplain retreat, they actually have really distinct differences. And so Liz Kozlov is very right that the unbuilding and returning to open space is an important element of planned retreat.
Well, and if you take some of those coastal areas and let them grow into natural habitat that can absorb some of the sea, you actually improve the situation for the people living further back.
Absolutely. When you have more green land, it can act like a sponge and it can soak up the floodwater that would otherwise rush in and damage other people's homes. There are all kinds of other ways people are using these lands, too. You can restore it as a wetland, so it soaks up more water. You could have it as a public park. There are cities around the United States that have done this managed retreat process, and now they have soccer fields or running trails or, you know, tennis courts that can soak up this water. Other places are doing community gardens. We see some efforts now in Houston where the Nature Conservancy in Houston are taking lands that have gone through managed retreat, and they're actually using them to create what they're calling pocket prairies. So it's habitat for endangered species on these lands. So it helps people against floods, but it can serve all kinds of other benefits as well if it's managed in the right way.
Now, looking to current events, nobody's had enough time to start counting how many people really died in the recent devastation on those two Bahamian islands during Hurricane Dorian. But the aerial photos make it clear that homes for tens of thousands of people were entirely demolished. Should those places be resettled? What do you picture happening there?
The challenge in the Bahamas and many island nations is extreme. In the United States, we're fortunate that we have a lot of space. People can move 2 miles from the ocean, still have access to the ocean, but be safer. Or, you know, at the very extreme, we have space in the Midwest and other places that's safe. The challenge in a place like the Bahamas is that there isn't that kind of space. So the difficulty is going to be finding places that are safer within the Bahamas. Should we rebuild homes in places where we know people will be put at risk? Not without serious consideration and not without doing something to make sure that they're safer the next time. Not everywhere that is at risk needs to retreat, but it needs to be one of the options that's available to them. And that's what I hope will be happening in the Bahamas, is that some communities will rebuild, and they will rebuild in a different way that makes them more resilient to future hurricanes. But some communities will choose not to rebuild, or it just won't be possible to rebuild in that place in a safe way. And I hope that those communities are going to receive support so that they can retreat in a managed way, not ad hoc, not without help, but with support and with a plan to make sure that they're safer in the long term.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. A.R. Siders from the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware. We're talking about planned retreat from places made unlivable by climate change. I think some of your work might finally find some application and funding if the international community gets its act together so that the wealthy nations step up and help to pay the victims of our fossil fuel burning. Do you see that coming down the pipe?
And that's a difficult question. Negotiations are always ongoing. I think the effects of climate change are becoming more apparent, and people are realizing that the need for these funds is more real. I will say, however, that I am doubtful that the money will be released in the time and in the amounts that are needed in order to take action. It doesn't do us any good if, you know, we get a few million dollars 10 years from now. People need large sums of money, and they need them now so they can start planning for these effects that are happening. That's going to be the challenge.
And you raised the issue of the social equity challenge, and I'm told that some of the residents of that poor community destroyed in Abaco Island, Bahamas, were refugees from the collapse of Haiti's economy. So those survivors will be refugees twice. The wealthy have the resources to move somewhere else while the poorest people are left at the highest risk. How do we handle that?
That's exactly right. And actually, that's one of the arguments that my co-authors and I make in the paper in Science, is this idea that if we don't have a managed retreat policy, every time someone stands up and says, we won't retreat, you know, we're going to rebuild, there are people who want to leave. And the people who have the resources are able to leave, even if there's no government program. But if there's no government program, then some people will be stuck. They won't have the resources, they won't have the option, and they can become trapped. The literature talks about trapped populations, which people are stuck in these at-risk areas without the resources to leave. We see this happening internationally. After major disasters, some people leave. They usually tend to be people who have resources or connections elsewhere. We also see it in the United States. We see the people who are able to walk away from their homes, who can find a new job or get out of their at-risk areas, and the people who are most at risk are left behind. And this is the reason that we need a planned retreat. It's why we talk about strategic and managed retreat, not just ad hoc, independent, but actually something that has resources and support behind it. That's one way to try to address some of these equity issues, is by providing resources to those who want to relocate but are not able to do so on their own means.
But, A.R. Siders, this sounds like a lot of taxpayers' money. If people who have a lot more money than I do decide to buy that oceanfront property, despite pretty common knowledge now about global warming, why should my taxes pay to fix their mistake?
This is an excellent question, and I'd love to turn it back around on you. So the options right now to adapt to climate change, as they're usually put out, are to resist the water. So think about building a seawall or putting dunes in place. They're to accommodate, like elevating a home, or they're to retreat and relocate. Right now in the United States, your tax dollars, my tax dollars, are going to pay for beach renourishment. We're digging up sand out of the ocean and putting it on a beach. And every time a hurricane comes, it takes that sand away, and then we go pay to put more sand back on that beach. We're paying to build the walls that then crumble or are overtopped, as we see in Sandy and we see in Katrina. We're paying to do all of these things over and over and over again. And that's the trick. We have to pay over and over and over again. With managed retreat, you pay once, and then that person is gone, and there isn't a house there. So you don't have to you don't have to move it over and over again. You do it once, and it's done. So is it a no-cost option? No. But can it be cost-effective when compared to the other options that we have? Yes, it can.
As you discuss in your paper, a lot of our human problem is our mental attachment to, you know, the way things have always been or the place where families have grown up. And that aspect of retreat almost seems like a problem for something like social psychology. How do we deal with those deep-seated feelings that prevent people from going with a positive plan for retreat?
This is an emerging area of research. It's an area where we need a lot more work to happen, but it's an area I'm excited about because people are coming up with really innovative ideas. So we see people who have homecoming parties. Portsmouth, North Carolina had a community, and they relocated because it was too at risk from hurricanes and storms. But every other year, they host a homecoming party. So people who used to live on the island, people who are interested in it, want to learn about the history or why they retreated, go back and have a big party so they can see people and try to maintain that sense of connection and sense of place even after they've relocated. There are other options going on, and could we have more art exhibitions? Could we have people who help be able to return to a space? When managed retreat occurs, it's not as though the ocean ceases to exist or you are forever forbidden from returning to the ocean. It's just that you don't live on it anymore. So what can we do to support people having a connection to the ocean that relies more on their recreation and activities or culture and less on their physical residence? artists are getting involved in this. There's some great theater groups. There's work with cultural historians who look at heritage sites and how those play a role and where people feel a connection to place. It's an area where, as I said, a lot more work needs to be done, but there's also some exciting innovation.
And I noticed in your bio info that you served as a Presidential Management Fellow with the U.S. Navy. What is a Presidential Management Fellow, and what did you do there?
Yeah, so the Presidential Management Fellowship Program is a federal government-wide program to bring graduate students into the government. So people apply who want to be in public service, and then go and spend 2 years with a particular agency, learning about that agency and how to do management at that agency and what that entails. So I spent 2 years with the U.S. Navy, with the Chief of Naval Operations Office, and I served in a variety of functions. The Navy's office moved us around a lot, so I worked on things from international research cooperation to counter-piracy and spent a little time with NATO. We worked on capacity building in Africa. It was a really wonderful 2 years. And to cap it all off, I got to work with Task Force Climate Change and with then-Admiral Dave Titley, with the oceanographer of the Navy at the time. And the Navy's work on climate change and climate adaptation is actually what got me interested in working on this area, because the military understands that they still have to plan for uncertainty. They're very comfortable planning for the what-ifs in the future and the probablys but not certains. So it was a fascinating way to get involved in realizing how important this is for our ports, our coasts, our national security.
Yeah, the Navy's going to have to relocate their biggest base on the East Coast and a lot of other places as well. Now, part of your conclusions in that science article will be difficult to sell to me and to some of our listeners. Like our recent guest, John Englander, you emphasize that retreat is really moving forward towards something more positive. Can you give us that vision a bit?
Yeah. So we're asking people to leave and leave their homes, leave the places they know. And the answer is why? And this can be something, so when we say give them a vision to move forward, it can be something simple. Build the new school. Build the new magnet school on the safe side of town, so that people have a reason to live close to that. Big private industries. You know, could you put your headquarters in a safer place and not, say, fill in a wetland and build your headquarters on top of it? You know, if you build in a safer place, your employees will live in a safer place, their commutes will be safer, it's better for your business overall, etc. So it can be something really tangible, like a job or a school. Or it can be giving them a vision. Communities that are relocating as an entire community have come up with how they want their new community to look. Do they want to have big communal spaces? Everyone's town has those things where you look back and you think, that road is in the wrong place, or that really doesn't make any sense, and you'd fix it if you could start over with a blank slate. Well, in some ways, Managed Retreat gives you that blank slate to imagine what you would want. If you could design your perfect town, what would it look like? And here's an opportunity to be creative and try to give people something really positive to look forward to. It could even be an ideal. Like Rosetta Elkin at the Harvard Graduate School of Design talks about seashores and national seashores. Could you create a huge national park where people could go hunt and fish but not live? And would that be enough to connect us to the ocean while keeping people not being at risk? So it could be something really practical, like a job. It could be something a little bit larger scale, like designing a new community, or it could be something that's much more aspirational. Like we really want an open, clean beach to leave to our, you know, grandchildren or to enjoy ourselves. So retreat is one way to try to get towards those goals. I think when you start focusing on what you're moving towards and why you're doing this and stop focusing on what you're losing, it can help people overcome some of those hurdles.
Have you seen places or communities or governments where they're moving towards doing retreat well instead of just leaving it all to panic as the decades unfold?
So we do see more and more examples popping up. Determining whether or not they're doing it well is a very difficult problem. We don't have great metrics for what it means to do retreat well. But some examples that I like from the Dutch are considered masters of flood management, and they have a project called Room for the River, where many people, thousands of people, were relocated and the land was returned to open space so that when the river floods, it has a place where it can flood and it doesn't go into the city and flood the dense urban area. Instead, it has this rural, open, grassy place where it can flood instead. That one has been at least very successful in terms of large scale, creating open space, using it for flood protection. In the United States, one of my favorite examples is Soldiers Grove, Wisconsin. They actually relocated back in the 70s because they're on the Kickapoo River and it flooded over and over and over again. And finally, they got funding to relocate their entire business district and to relocate most of the residences. And the reason I think this was a really interesting example is because they took this idea of moving towards something better. They said, if we're going to relocate, let's relocate in a way that helps us as a community. So they relocated so their business district would be nearer to the highway, so they'd have more traffic, and it would help their economic growth. They invested in, I believe they invested in nursing homes because of their aging population. They put in a new well because it had been contaminated by the floods. And they put in regulations to have their business district be solar powered. I mean, in the 1970s in Wisconsin, they were going by the nickname the Solar Town because they had these solar power regulations. So they had really revitalized their town with a new sense of serving their businesses, serving individuals. It wasn't about fleeing from the river. It was about building something better. And that, I think, is a really important lesson for other people who are thinking about engaging in retreat to take.
Well, we're reaching the end of our time together, but I'm wondering, what will you be working on next?
So this is an issue that is complicated enough, thankfully, that I'm going to continue working on it. And this issue exactly that we just discussed, this issue of how do we evaluate managed retreat programs? How do we know if they were successful? And what lessons can we learn from what people have already done will be one of my next projects. So I'm continuing to work with my co-authors on this, Catherine Mock and Miyuki Hino, and we'll be working with others on gathering case studies of how people have done this and what innovations they're coming up with.
From the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware, we've been speaking with Dr. A.R. Siders. You can find links to follow up more on this in my show blog at ecoshock.org. A.R. Siders, thank you so much for helping us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.